History.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you. I was wondering if somebody was going to say Fergie Jenkins or Three Fingered Brown or some, or Lon Warnicki or somebody like that. What was that? Okay, that too. Now, the root of this presentation. You didn't like that. Okay. So I guess I better not give you a math riddle then, because I was going to do that. Okay. I was in Catalina Island off the coast of Long Beach in January, where of course we all were last year. I came across this book called Root for the Cubs by Roger Snell. I understand that the author did a presentation about this book in the Ohio chapter, courtesy of John Schleppi telling me about that. And it might not be that well known, unless you're a Cub fan, that they trained on Catalina Island from 1921 to 1951. And so, since I tend to like to do something fairly regional to the area that we're in, when I came across this idea, well, okay, 2012 is the 80th anniversary of the so-called called shot, which Root and family and teammates denied ever happened. Now, before I get to say more about that, the real context of this presentation was to talk about Charlie Root's career, you know, beyond the called shot, what kind of pitcher was he, what kind of person was he, and this book by Roger Snell, which takes a lot of anecdotal information from his daughter Della, who was 90 years old at the time the book was researched and written, and it gave a lot of insight into Charlie Root's career. Now, what I decided to do in terms of looking at the context of Root's career, and this is in the handout, hopefully you can see this as well, is to put Root's, first of all, his career in context with his contemporaries, what I've called the Fab 15, as opposed to the Beatles, the Fab Four, you know, that kind of thing. So, in the different columns, you see wins, losses, percent, ERA, ERA plus, of course, is adjusted ERA, and PW is the player wins number from that big, thick baseball encyclopedia, which they don't print anymore. Charlie Root's is the first entry. What I wanted to do, first of all, was how does he compare to his contemporaries? By the way, this hat I'm wearing is a replica of a 1926 Cubs hat that I got when I was down in Wrigley Field. I was in Chicago before I came here, and I couldn't pass up the CD that has that song, you know, "Hey Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are going to win today," which some of you probably know. Now, if you look at this list, and there's other charts to come, how does Root compare to his contemporaries? Down the list is George Yulee, whom I talked about. I had a poster presentation for him at the Cleveland Convention. Some of these people have very similar one-loss records, at least on the surface, to Root. You look at Bucky Walters, they're just below. You look at a whole bunch of other people. So I was looking more or less at people on this chart of the Fab 15 who had some similarities to Root's career. You'd also have to take, of course, into context the era in which they played. Root didn't stick with the 23 Browns. He was in the PCL for a couple of years, did very well, finally surfaced in 1926. So by the time he really hit his stride, and this book that I just mentioned highlights the 29th season, how McCarthy built the Cubs, the arrival of Hornsby, Hack Wilson's big year, and what Root's accomplishments were. He was already close to 30 years old, so you'd have to take that kind of thing into account, starting the career rather late. So that's one issue right there. And of course, as probably you all know, 20s and 30s were big hitters era, so some of the ERAs might seem high to you, but you have to consider the era in which they played. So this chart, for your interest, I think would help us think about how does Root compare to his contemporaries, and also as a related point, some ideas about have the right people been chosen for the Hall of Fame. Now, what I did, and this is something I could do in my stat classes, I'll try not to hit you up with too much math, although maybe I'll hit you up with a math riddle later. In statistics, we talk about analyzing and arranging data. You can break a data set into low, the high, divided in half, which is the median, and then half and half again, you divide it into quarters, so you create what's called quartiles. So what I was especially interested in was the adjusted ERA, which you find basically by taking the league ERA divided by the individual's ERA, times 100, and then times the home park factor. Although, of course, the nuance to that is they do pitch on the road, but that's basically what we do. Now, what I wanted to do is, in looking at the adjusted ERA, aside from the statistics of it, and I tossed in the standard deviation. We use that a lot in statistics as a measure of the spread or dispersion of scores about the mean. Now, what I wanted to do with this table for adjusted earned run average, taking the league conditions and the home park factor into account, is to think about, if you look at these numbers, and which of these people are in the Hall of Fame. So you can see, since I arranged them from low to high, which you would always have to do to find the median middle number, as well as everything else, then you can see, where does Charlie Root with his 110 adjusted ERA fit into the scheme of things with everybody else? And you can also see from this chart that only a few of these people are in the Hall of Fame. And of course, Sabre always likes to argue who belongs and who doesn't. But this might give some further insight into where does Root stand compared to his contemporaries, and what other statistical data could you look at, sort of beyond what's normally done in looking at stuff like this. Now, here's something I started to work on recently. Some of you may recognize this from the Bill James book from the 90s, The Politics of Glory and What Happened to the Hall of Fame. The Fibonacci win point system, which I personally think weights wins too much, and I've played around with some other formulas. That's a subject for another day. So I present some numbers for Root, Lyons, Hayes, and other people. And it's based upon the idea that when you have this Fibonacci sequence and certain numbers that reflect the win percent, like 0.618 is sort of the magic number that gets used in some calculations. Here's yet another system to evaluate pitchers and help you think about maybe who belongs in the hall and who doesn't. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. If this were a math class, I could go all day with this, but I won't. Unless somebody wants me to. Oh, I guess I better not. Okay, now, to talk further about Root's career, the basic numbers can be looked up, of course, but in looking at some of his, like, I took his basically his first 10 years, and looking at the adjusted ERA that I already referred to, season by season, PW, the pitcher win number from the Baseball Encyclopedia, and probably a lot of you know the last column, wins above replacement, WAR. So these are some numbers to look at to put his career into context. Now, if you look at the adjusted ERA, you can see that on the one hand, 1927, he peaked with 26 wins. But his adjusted ERA is not as good as 1926, which was basically his rookie year. He had a few other good adjusted ERA seasons. 1929, when at the start of the season, he was concerned that he had a sore arm, but it turned out that he had a very good season. And he did pitch, by the way, the opening game in the 29 series against the Philadelphia A's. Then some other good seasons later on, 1933 and 1935. There were a couple of other good wins above replacement seasons where evidently five is the level at which he would be considered an all-star. Now, 1934, he might have been injured. I need to do a little more research about that. But I think you can see that he was fairly consistent during the time when it was very definitely a hitter's era. And as I mentioned before, he also started late. So by 1929, when he was considered the ace of the staff, he was already 30 years old. And remember, they didn't have the sports medicine in those days that they have today. Now, it also needs to be said that Ruth was a good family man, and by 1929 he was also considered one of the leaders of the team, and that people would all often congregate at the Ruth family house. And one of the things that was mentioned in this book that's of special interest to me is that Charlie Grimm played the banjo. I play also, although I'm not a seasoned player, of course, but So that sort of musical element that Charlie Grimm played the banjo, and that there was sort of a family atmosphere to the Cubs of that era, which you probably don't have today, added something to my sense of what Charlie Root was like as a person, you know, very devoted to his family. His daughter Della, who was about 10 years old during that 1929 season, supplied a lot of anecdotes in terms of how should people remember Charlie Root today? That, you know, he had a solid career and that he was a good family man, that he seemed to care about his teammates, and that it was interesting that the book noted that until the 1950s, Root and Hartnett were the only battery to make four World Series appearances. By the way, one of the backgrounds to that 29th season, speaking of Hartnett, one of three Hall of Famers from the state of Rhode Island, by the way, was that Hartnett actually was injured and didn't play very much in that year. So that was an issue for the Cubs, that they didn't have Hartnett's strength, which they had later on. One of the things that's also of interest to me as a math stat person was the Cubs winning the pennant in 29, 32, 35, and 38. Every 3 years, what we call an arithmetic progression for you math folks out there. So I like that sort of thing. And the Cubs generally were contenders throughout that decade of the 1930s, which is not as well known as it should be. In terms of the World Series, Root started the 1929 opening game, the series where the Philadelphia A's had that famous 10-run inning where Hack Wilson dropped a couple of balls in the outfield. And I know that was a disappointment that the Cubs lost that series. And then now to relate that to 1932, toward the end of that book, when Root was facing the aforementioned George Herman in 1932. There was a lot of razzing and bench jockeying back and forth. And so Root had two strikes on him. And according to the accounts, and evidently there was some film that was taken of that particular situation. The mythology is that Root did that, as if to say the next ball's going into the center field seats. Well, Charlie Root was often quoted as saying, if I'd known that was what Ruth was doing, what do you think Root would have done? He would have knocked him down the way, you know, Gibson or Drysdale used to do. And what probably happened was that Root went like this to say, I've got one strike left, because there were a lot of razzing back and forth. And so I think that was a rather interesting scenario, that there was the mythology that, you know, Ruth did that. Now, while he did hit a home run on a two-strike pitch that was outside but not far enough, I think Ruth was always bothered by the notion that people were going to remember him just for that, when what I hope to have convinced you about was that Ruth had a very solid career. Evidently, his relatives in California had license plates made up saying Babe Who, which I thought was pretty cute. So, I think with that, I'm going to stop and take some questions and comments. If any Cub fans in the room in particular would like to comment, please do. Go ahead, please. Thank you. And speak up.
Have you seen the film that Bob Costa showed of Ruth clearly pointing into the dugout? It was taken by a fan, back row, field level at Wrigley Field.
I haven't seen that particular one, but tell us more.
A fan of the game had a movie camera, was taking film. Bob Costas got a hold of it somehow, and he showed it to tell you how old this was, Mickey Mantle, among others, and Reggie Jackson, and he asked them, did they believe that Babe Ruth was calling the shot? And universally, they believed that what Babe Ruth was doing was pointing into the Cubs dugout and making commentary back to the players and coaches in the dugout about what was going on and not pointing out to the center field fence. which I think backs up a lot of what Trevor Reed had to say.
I think so too. I agree. Yeah, please.
Right before he was swinged, literally probably while he was in his lineup, Rudy pumped one of his two hands. I would pump my right hand for my right hand back. He may very well have pumped the left hand since he was swinging one hand. That is something that Rudy personally wouldn't have seen if he would have been busy with the, process to get the ball. It's not a big gesture, you know, this kind of way.
Yeah.
It's more like you're in, you know, kind of thing.
And I think also, what Ruth was quoted as saying when people asked him about that incident, he said he was reported as saying something like, "Well, it's all in the papers. You can read about it in the papers." So he didn't flat out confirm or deny. But if he really felt it happened, being the showman that he evidently was, so I'm sorry we can't get him on the phone now. But if he really thought he'd done that, he probably would have backed it up. Let's see. Let's go over here. Thank you.
Do you have a chance to read any of the print journalists of the day in the Chicago New York papers to see what they were writing about the day after that took place, many of the countervailing arguments there?
Not directly, but this book mentioned that in terms of quoting what different journalists of the day were saying, and that evidently some of the journalists who reported on that World Series game didn't even mention the incident, and that that Charlie Ruth's daughter Della was upset that one reporter, Paul Gallico, who was famous in the day, reported on the incident a few days later but wasn't even at the game. So in terms of the secondary aspects of reporting on the journalism, it's not like it really was played up that much. But that's a good point. Let's go over there again, please.
What was Ruth's reputation as a hitter and as a fielder? And in terms of Hall of Fame candidacy, do you think it's valid to take those into consideration?
Very good question. He was among the leaders in a number of pitching categories throughout the 1930s. I looked at his fielding data. I provide on the handout a number of references. His fielding evidently was rather good. He went through a number of seasons where he made no errors at all. He wasn't really known as a hitter. In 1929, he did have one home run and 15 RBIs. So the fielding was very good. And I think in terms of the Hall of Fame, he's probably borderline at best, but I'd like to hear from you about that. But I'm glad you brought that up, because that's part of the context of looking at Root to remember him for his career overall and not for one thing. And that's one good question. Go ahead, please.
If Root's cold shot wasn't really played up at the time, how did it evolve into the legend that we have today?
Well, since there were a couple of the journalists who did write about it, then it did get some play in the paper. This book I referred to also mentioned that Ruth's Cubs teammates, who were very close to the situation, all pretty much reported what that gentleman over there was saying. And Ruth was going like this, pointing to the Cub dugout, and then maybe out to Ruth to say, "I've got one more strike left." And well, the book was also reporting that he was razzing Guy Bush, the next day starter, one of their four main pitchers, to say, "I'll get you the next day." So I think that's part of the context of it. Good, Paul. Good.
12 years ago, I get a call from a gentleman in Wyoming who said, "I have some interesting footage. Would you like to see it?" And explain it. And we eventually set up a Sabre chapter meeting in Denver. And he wrote this footage down. It was taken by his great uncle at that game, 1930. He had a moving camera from a different angle than the what everybody's seeing. The Costas footage, all that. And what seems to be quite evident from the footage is that Ruth was pointing toward the Cub dugout, which is on third base at the time. The only way that he could have been pointing anywhere else was if it happened at different at bat. But Ruth hit two homers that game,
I think.
And the Cub bench was riding him mercilessly. And he was just pointing at the Cub dugout, and this is a big, completely different angle than, world famous footage. But one thing is completely clear in this footage, and that is after he hit the home run, Ruth came around, and you can see this on the other footage, when he got to third base, from being flipped off the top dugout, and he held up Bird from third base all the way in the home plate. Never let it down. Babe Ruth, all the way in.
Thank you. Was that the Candle Filaments, K-A-N-D-L-E?
No.
Oh, okay, because there was probably different footages. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
There's a question about his. What was his World Series record as a pitcher? He appeared in one of the World Series with the Cubs.
He was something like 0-3 or 0-4. He didn't actually win any games.
Right. That hurts his credentials for Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that relates to the previous question. Good. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead, please. Pitching analysis, focusing on contextual features like wins versus team ERA per 250 innings versus team. And I know a couple pitchers that the underrated pitchers, Urban Shocker was a little earlier, and Eddie Rommel, and Dutch Leonard, who could be regarded a bit later. But as for Lyons, I think if you do it contextually, he certainly deserves very much. Although I think he's the only Hall of Famer who walked more than he struck out, if I'm right on that. But I would say, as a Cub fan, I would say Ruth quite qualifies. And then later, as you know, he was moved to the bullpen about the mid-30s and finished his career sort of as a relief pitcher.
Yeah, the data from his career seems to show that, and I also wonder, maybe Cub fans could comment, is it possible that he pitched a little too long? You know, that maybe, because he was still pitching 1938, 1939 when he was 40 years old. And by the way, he did stay in baseball. He was a Cub pitching coach. He was also the pitching coach for the 57 Braves, and you know about them. There was a hand back there. I don't know how much more time do we have.
Yeah. 2 minutes.
A couple of hands back there. Go ahead, please.
Regarding the bench jockeying between the Yankees and Cubs, I've heard that much of that was based on the fact that former Yankee Mark Koenig had signed with the Cubs in the season and helped them win the pennant, but they did not give him a full playoff shot.
Right.
And the Yankees were bitter about that.
Yes.
And that led to a lot of hard feelings between the two franchises.
Yes, that's an excellent point, and that along with what Paul was saying, that there was a definite context of rivalry and bitterness that fueled that whole situation. Anybody else? Last call. Go ahead, please.
Did you try to say anything about his chances of getting into the Hall of Fame? How do you feel about it?
I think he was generally pretty quiet about it. I think he probably would have liked to. I think his family was a big booster of his career, and they wanted him to be known for what he did overall, not just for one situation. But I think, you know, that commentary from the Cub fans in particular is well taken, because as we know, sometimes people tend to be forgotten about by history, and I hope this presentation can shed some light on that. Go ahead, please.
Next one.
If I understand you correctly, the way that this version is not correct.
Well, you know, in fact, related to that, when there was subsequent to Root's career, when there were ideas about making movies about the incident, Charlie Root refused to participate if that incident was going to be repeated. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.